Hello and welcome to another episode of the Breachside Broadcast, home of the finest voxcasting either side of the breach. On today's episode, we meet Maxine Agassiz, one of the most brilliant minds in Malifaux. Together with her crew of inventors, engineers, sailors and fighters, she sails the seas of Malifaux, determined to unravel the many mysteries created by the arrival of the Burning Man. I hope you enjoy part one of Uncharted Waters, right after this word from our sponsor. This episode of the Breachside Broadcast is brought to you by Jeremiah Coppersneath's Research Assistants. We specialise in dangerous and esoteric research that regular researchers won't touch. If you've got a book that causes insanity or an experiment that may trigger an ancient curse, contact our team. Rest assured, graduate students are inexpensive and highly expendable.
Uncharted Waters by Mike Wallace. In all chaos there is order. It was the mantra of the scientist, the simple belief that there is no true chaos, merely patterns that have not been defined, or new variables that alter existing ones into unfamiliar forms. All one needed was time, and the necessary calculations to break them down into something that could again be codified. Maxine Agassiz's study had become an apt analogy of this. Her normally pristine office had been slowly transformed from a place of organized peace to a cluttered nightmare. Papers, covered in notes and addendums of notes, formed mountains on the desk and tables, surrounded by empty inkpots and long-forgotten cups of tea. Maxine sat in her favorite chair, one hand absently spinning a sepia-toned globe of the earth marked with red pins. London, San Francisco, points of the world where the cult of the Burning Man, or some other force, had opened their portals to that distant world of Malifaux, permitting the horrors of that place to spill forward. Within arm's reach was an old chalkboard, marked with weaving calculations of mathematical formulas. It was pure, disconnected nonsense to anyone who tried to read it, and yet Maxine's months-long studies had pointed to no other possibilities. She simply couldn't turn the nonsense into a pattern. She ran a hand through tousled grey hair and straightened her jacket. Wild eyes, heavy with dark circles, picked over every disheveled detail. "What was that, dear?" Maxine started, roused from her churning thoughts. What? She turned. Her husband, Orville, who up until now had been more interested in trying to forge an aeroplane design out of his handkerchief, looked at her. "You said something very grand, philosophical. Pit your mind against the frenzied vagaries of disorder and make them fall in line, or something like that." Orville threw his cloth aeroplane and became crestfallen when it landed on the floor in a soft heap. Despite herself, Maxine smiled. "The portals, Orville. It's still the portals." She went to a corkboard next to her messy desk, thumping a thin fist against the pages she'd torn out of various journals and publications. Many of the insights given to her were underlined or circled. A map of Earth hung close by, stuck with bright orange pins linked together with yarn. Maxine had been looking at the same repeating numbers and articles for weeks. Rubbing her eyes in frustration, she turned to a collection of dog-eared, heavily annotated copies of her most promising research guides, published by the finest minds of the age. Luminous Bridges by Atos, Stabilization of Interdimensional Tunnels by Heinzmann, Mechanized Magic, A Journey from Superstition to Science by Ramos. She had a heck of a time getting hold of that last one, after all his books were banned. But it was another that caught her eye, just briefly. Hidden away under another stack of papers, but always within reach. A heavily abridged, excessively censored copy of the Flamme by none other than Ephraim Wade himself. Acquiring the thin book had taken weeks of time, money, and manpower, hiring more than 200 individuals and paying them handsomely to risk their sanity transcribing each individual page. Peeling away the pseudo-religious gibberish and superstitious hearsay, dampening the mimetic effects the book had on the mind until all that was left were some curiously informative notes on the nature of interdimensional portals, the greatest weapon the cult had against the rest of the world. Not diving too deeply into that crazy man's book, are you, dearest? Orville asked, peering over Maxine's shoulder as best he could from his wife's desk chair. Hush, Maxine said. She grabbed a handful of papers. Here, you're looking positively bored. He gleefully began folding the papers together, while Maxine turned to the chalkboard and the mathematical formulas that took up every inch of available space. It makes no sense. Orville was well into crafting the third plane for his paper fleet. Why don't you talk it out, dearest, like we did in our old academic days? Maxine exhaled, trying to wipe her mind clean and start from the beginning. From these books I've learned that portals, even small ones, require a tremendous amount of power, more than can normally be sustained by a single person or a group of people, even with a steady cache of charged soul stones. Orville gave it some thought. That makes sense. Where is this power coming from? She pointed at him. I'm getting to that. My point is that these energies normally disperse. Ley lines form and scatter, but they don't gather. Until now. Etheric energies are gathering in these ley lines. They're bloating? Like a tick? Orville offered hopefully. Maxine hesitated, chewing on the imagery, but agreed. Yes. Atoza's book, Luminous Bridges, states that Earth is suffused with ley lines, natural currents of unbound etheric energies, magic, that crisscross the planet. Even in a weakened state, these currents can be measured and accounted for. These energies are like rivers or electricity, always moving along the path of least resistance. To where? Nowhere, Maxine said, almost wailing, throwing her hands into the air. Dissipation, entropy. It doesn't make any sense. Mathematically, we should be able to chart when the lines swell with power, but they just don't seem to behave in any sort of fashion. The Burning Man is just madness. Orville frowned through his moustache. Maxine's shoulders slumped. She looked so tired. But if there was one thing Orville had learned, it was that he couldn't stop Maxine from tackling the hardest problems in the scientific world. He hugged her, kissing her forehead. Well, ticks or not, you don't get any energy from ley lines. We've missed you at dinner. I hear Martin is making his famous roast turkey. Mashed potatoes, butter, maybe even rolls. Orville smacked his lips over dramatically. Maxine gave him a quiet smile but didn't look up. Orville squeezed her again before scooting out the office door. I'll have him save your plate. The chalk-filled slate loomed over Maxine. It was chaos. But wherever there was chaos, there had to be order. The cover of the Flamme drew her eye. Puckered leather made up the cover, stamped with runes to ensure the book's latent magic couldn't affect anyone nearby. One corner was cracked, the leather split into little spiderwebs from a central point. A tick. Maxine's eyes raced, brain barely keeping up with her rapid calculations. She raised her hand and pinched the back. The skin went pale from the pressure, then returned to its normal color when she let go. It was a gathering, an abundance, a flood based on where pressure had been applied. Scrambling for her chalk, Maxine whispered to herself, tracing back over her calculations. She cleaned off a new space with her sleeve and immediately filled it with another long string of looping variables and numbers. She stepped back, feverishly looking over her work. Orville! Orville! Orville's voice grew louder as he meandered back down the hall. Change your mind about that turkey, my love. I would offer to carry you down the stairs, but the knees aren't as spry as they used to be. What say you hop on my back? Might be easier to get better leverage. Fulcrums. Maybe I could make some sort of launching device. Just come here. Maxine dragged her husband into the study, kicking piles of paper and books out of the way. She parked him in front of the slate and pointed to her latest equation. This. Here. Does that make sense? Does the formula equal out? Orville stroked his walrus-like whiskers and furrowed his brow. A few moments later, a wide smile broke across his face. Maxine exchanged glances with her husband, eyes brimming with tears of relief. He smiled at her, a twinkle in his eye. Shall I tell Kaya to ready the superior? She practically jumped into his arms, and he spun her around, the two of them laughing. Barely a week later, the crew of the EVS were assembled in the helm. Maxine stood in front of them, still tired, but looking much healthier than she had in a long while. She cleared her throat. Thank you all for your patience and trust. I know things have been rather secretive these past few weeks, but now is the time to reveal why I've dragged us all out here. The first to speak was the newcomer, Dr. Ogden Beebe, a hands-on engineer type in frayed pinstripe trousers and a vest. He looked as frazzled as Maxine felt, though far better rested, and he'd solved the problem of the messy hair by keeping his head shaved smooth. And why would that be? Maxine stared at him a moment, trying to figure out if the small smile Beebe wore was mocking, or just an understanding of academic stress. Portals, Doctor. We're discussing portals. Specifically the portals that have plagued the Earth in recent years. Just recently. Arata Nugatoro stood up straighter, arms folded over his bare chest. The young Maori man blended the traditional culture of his people with the practicalities of modern conveniences. Facial tattoos and a necklace accompanied a belt and trousers. More consistently, Maxine corrected herself. She drew a map from her desk, upending several scattered papers to free it from under the pile. She spread the map out in front of them, revealing a handful of spots marked with blue ink. Here, here, and here. Points that correspond to the most recent openings. She paused, frowning. Then took up a pen, dabbed in a few ink pots to find a fresh supply, and marked a fourth and final location somewhere off the coast of Greenland. This point marks the newest build-up. Kiamanami, a powerfully built Abyssinian warrior with a perpetual scowl, curled her eyebrow at the display. Mom, have you been getting enough sleep? Of course not, Maxine said, brushing the notion aside, but that's hardly relevant. This is the culmination of my research. I believe I have discovered a formula. This formula, combined with the detection and sampling equipment on board the Superior, is what has led us to this spot. She jabbed a finger at the mark over the Atlantic. If my theory is correct, a portal will open on this very location, and if that is the case, it would mean you can detect cult portals before they open, Kaya said. Her eyes went wide. A military force could mobilize to contain their attacks before they even began. Not just the cults, Beebe agreed, but the wild breaches to Malifaux, the ones that have allowed so much of their ecosystem to run rampant on Earth, the gibbering hordes in particular. The gathered audience looked over the map. How did you detect these build-ups? Kaya asked. Even my people do not have the means. Maxine's eyes wandered to an empty corner of the room, and she tucked away a few errant locks of hair behind her ear. Well, that is, my careful, very careful studies into the Flamme have revealed an emphasis on certain geological constants that... Wait, Beebe asked, holding up a hand. The Flamme? Maxine nodded, and continued nodding as she shoved the pile of papers aside, muttering something under her breath, and brought up a leather-bound book branded with the image of the Burning Man cult. Everyone, except perhaps Orville, who merely chuckled, took a step back from the tome. Kapane, Harata spoke, one hand up in a gesture of warding. You are aware of that book's effect on people. I wouldn't go poking at this thing if I hadn't carefully abridged and censored it, Maxine said. She flipped it open, revealing tear marks from missing pages, and entire passages covered in pitch-black ink. It costs a fortune in research aids, but it's perfectly safe. Mostly. The levels of cognitive hazard are minimal with brief exposure. There was silence throughout the small room. Maxine could feel the seconds ticking by, and suddenly she felt very small. Orville's hand on her shoulder was a comfort, and she tried to take a deep breath. Arata finally spoke. "I trust you. If the Waters told you to be here, then I am too." A grunt of agreement from Kaya, and Beeb eventually shrugged his shoulders. "I've heard stranger hypotheses before. These are strange times, but if anyone could figure out that blue matchstick's patterns, it would be you." Maxine closed the flamme and tucked it into a desk drawer, relieved. "Thank you all. From this moment on, we're in this together, thick or thin." "That still doesn't explain our escorts," Kaya said, glaring out the windows at two very heavy guild steamships, a few hundred yards away from the exploration vessel Superior. "Ah, yes," Maxine sighed. "This expedition has been outsourced for funds, I'm afraid. It was that or sell the family copper mine, which I will not do." "You could have easily brought this formula to Abyssinia," Kaya said. She folded her arms. "They would have funded it as eagerly as the guild." "Or the King's Empire," Beeb added with a shrug. "Not to pick favorites, Miss Manamy." "I'm aware of all your concerns on this," Maxine admitted. "Trust me when I say the decision was not completely mine. I believe my investigations drew their attention, and when it became known that I was seeking to test my theory, they approached me first, and I didn't have time to turn this into a competition over something like money. The portal could be opened at any moment, and the guild has the naval forces to face whatever comes through the portal. When it opens. Hopefully." She exhaled, feeling far more tired than she had a moment before. Presentations always exhausted her. "Any questions?" The crew leaders exchanged practiced glances. Then Harata replied, "What do you need us to do?" Maxine smiled. "Tomorrow we'll begin collecting data. Kaya, I want the ship's systems focused on sample collection. Harata, that means you too. You know the water better than most. I'll need your perspective on the portal's effects." She looked to Beeb. "I'd like Calypso ready for a dive in the morning. Time to get her sea legs." "With gusto," Beeb agreed. "And Orville?" Maxine paused, noting Orville had begun putting a trio of paper airplanes through a series of loop-de-loops. "Get your wings charged and ready. I want airborne surveillance, at least out to a half mile from our coordinates." Orville hopped up, letting the planes scatter about the room, one of them lodging itself in his windswept white hair. "Ah, you know exactly how to liven the mood." She lovingly rolled her eyes. "Just don't be up late tinkering. I won't have you falling asleep in mid-flight again. We all need to stay sharp for when this thing opens. If it opens," Maxine added, softly enough so none of the departing crew could hear. The weather was not agreeable the next day. The Atlantic always seemed to be miserable. So cold, dark, and grey. A far cry from the soothing blues and warm winds of the Pacific. But the Atlantic had a prize, and that made it worth the extra layer of underwear. Even at the crack of dawn, the deck of the Superior was bustling. Work crews moved to Kaya's commanding chatter through the ethercoms. Beeb's team were already preparing Calypso for the crane at the aft section of the ship. The spherical construct coincidentally reminded Maxine of a squid, with a series of mechanical legs holding it up, and a collection of crab-like limbs extending from its sides that included gripping pincers, cutting and welding tools, and an assortment of manipulators and sample collectors that served Calypso's primary purpose, as a scientific exploration submersible. To her surprise, Beeb was not crammed into the tiny cockpit of the Calypso, instead unpacking a sizable control console that his team was dissembling and carrying in pieces into the submersible. It looked advanced but confusing, the work of a man who had not built Calypso's controls with an everyman interface in mind. "Not taking a dive yourself?" Maxine asked as she approached. Beeb gave her a bashful smile. "I considered, but decided I haven't yet had a chance to field test her under these conditions yet. Besides, I didn't spend half my research grant on two frequency-tuned soul stones just to leave them sitting in a crate." He hefted a portion of the console and began heading for the ship, and Maxine fell into step beside him. "What's the range on your console?" 1,000 meters, Beep said, nearly bragging. "Give or take. About the same length as her tether, and a few hundred below her maximum safe depth. I designed the transmitter and receiver to use the ocean water as a natural conductor, so we should get a clear signal." "I'm curious that you chose a remote console over a logic engine," Maxine remarked. "Oh, she has one," Beep said. "Not much more advanced than a dog, though. In the event of a transmission failure, or if the pilot is disabled, she's programmed to return to the surface and begin emitting a reclaim code." "Ah," Maxine said. "I guess it wouldn't help to have her doing her own thing while a pilot is trying to steer her." Beep's smile became a little wary. "Experience has taught me that when you're underwater, the last thing you want is for the machine to decide it doesn't want you on board." "Understandable," Maxine said, "as long as the readings stay clear." "No worries on that," Beep agreed. They arrived in the scanning room, and Maxine stepped aside for Beep to continue the installation of his console in a corner of the room. Around him, teams of machinists made use of some of the most advanced equipment seen on either side of the breach. Ether detection and ranging systems, hydroacoustics, electrical and temperature detectors, and more. Each console required its own master's degree to understand. Maxine, of course, had them all. Kaya entered, ducking under the bulkhead frame. "Morning." Maxine returned the greeting. "Ship's in good shape, Kaya."
"Yes, ma'am."
"All systems are a go, excluding Beeb's contraption." "Just wait till you see her in action," Beep insisted, working under his control console with a screwdriver. "She's impressed everyone so far, and I think even your sourpuss will appreciate such a fine bit of engineering." Kaya snorted, a hint of a smirk on her face. "We'll have to divert power from the generators to carry the additional drain. It shouldn't be a problem, as long as we're not running the engines." Moving the ship while Calypso was submersed is a bad idea anyways, Beep said, emerging from under the console. "It's basically an anchor while it's tethered, and I don't intend to drop it into the Atlantic." Maxine nodded in agreement. "What about the Guild escorts?" Kaya's lip twitched. "The Hammer is maintaining its escort distance. The Hoplite is engaging in combat drills. The feel of those guns hanging over my shoulder. I know. We all feel the same way," Maxine said. "But this is my vessel. You have my approval to do anything necessary to ensure the safety of this ship and its crew, even from the Guild." The broad Abyssinian woman barely let a smirk touch her face.
"Of course, ma'am."
"Good. Now where's Harata?"
"Fishing," Kaya said. "At the prow."
"I'll go check on him next. Call me before you launch Calypso, Doctor. I'd appreciate being there for her first sea voyage."
"It would be my honor."
Maxine smiled and left the scanning room, strolling down corridors of her ship, appreciating the feel of it being alive. The Superior was not a new vessel by any means, having been built around the turn of the century. It had been paid for, and partially built from, the rich copper mine she owned, and that made it as much a part of her legacy as the mine itself. Maxine had spared no expense ensuring that the Superior benefited from the most advanced materials and technologies she could buy or build herself. It was an older ship, but the halls were filled with discovery. As Maxine emerged near the prow, she took note of the harpoon guns that lined the deck. The armaments were one such recent addition, a necessity when so much of the world's oceans now held Malifaux's aquatic horrors, fending off sea monsters that had become a very real part of sailing Earth's seas. Kaya had contributed her own expertise to the task, improving the guns to Abyssinian standards, and building crude interpretations of Abyssinian shock spears that would deliver a lethal jolt to whatever they hit. Expensive, but Maxine would rather have them and not need them than vice versa. Harata was standing alone near the prow, staring into the waters below. The chill, wet wind of the Atlantic seemed to have no effect on him. His eyes were shut, flinching only slightly against the spray of the ocean, and he held a tethered net in both hands. "The sea is restless," he spoke.
just loud enough to be heard over the wind. A look of concern flashed over Maxine's features. Arata was inscrutable. Restless in a bad way? Maxine asked nervously. Arata laughed. It was a reassuring sound. Not at all, Capone. The Atlantic is temperamental, but talkative. Jealous, maybe, of her warmer sisters, but proud. Maxine quirked an eyebrow. And our objective? There is power here, he nodded. He cast a net into the waters, letting it trail from its rope along the starboard side of the ship. An energy that does not feel natural or native to these waters. I believe we are in the right spot. He hauled the rope up, his muscles straining as he brought up a net half full of struggling fish, which draws many hungry mouths.
Make way!
Came a cry from above. Maxine turned and ducked as Orville's bare foot swept past her head. He kicked and twisted, catching a headwind and soaring upward on a pair of broad mechanical wings, strapped to a rocket-propelled thruster pod on his back. It coughed a puff of black smoke and blue-green flames, fighting the wind.
Pardon me, dear.
Where is your shoe, you idiot? Maxine shouted. A few hundred feet below us, I'm afraid, Orville said. It was causing a bit too much drag anyway. She sighed, rubbing her temple before shouting, Did you at least get breakfast before you took off this morning? You know I never fly on an empty stomach, he answered, letting out a whoop as he did an impromptu flip. This wind is a fighter, but I won't go down like some two-bit boxer. Have at. Well, report your findings, Maxine called out, fighting against a smile tugging at the corner of her mouth. Plenty to see, Orville said, swooping low and landing on the deck. Oh, this deck is cold. The wings retracted with a stiff, robotic motion, though the thruster pod continued to hiss and smoke. Focus, Orville. We're here for a reason. Yes, yes, of course, dear. Well, I see no hide nor hair of any large fish, Orville said, readjusting the straps on his flight pack. Anything bigger than a mackerel is giving the area a wide berth. And there's discoloration in the water, extending to almost 1,000 meters in every direction. The water around us is warmer than that beyond, Arata added, transferring fish from his net to a large bucket filled with water. Interesting, Maxine mused. The etheric buildup could be part of it, unless... She frowned and tapped her chin. Unless the portal is already open, in some minute form, exchanging water from Malifaux to Earth. Not yet. The sea would have made it known, Arata said. The variations between the oceans of Earth and Malifaux are distinct, like when a tide and a stream meet in an estuary, in a manner of speaking. We can bring samples on board when Beeb's bathosphere launches, Orville piped in, slowly enunciating the unfamiliar word. He was standing on one foot, pressing his bare toes to his trousers in an effort to warm them. All the more reason for us to see it off. Let's go, Orville. We'll find you some shoes. Yes, dear, Orville said with a chuckle. The Calypso hit the water with a splash, bobbing for a few moments before beginning to sink, the cable that fastened it to the Superior slowly uncoiling. In the scanning room, everyone had gathered around Beeb's control console, watching the engineer deftly work the complex controls. Readings are a go across the board, seals are airtight. So far, so good. Can we see what she sees? Maxine asked, hovering a little over Beeb's shoulder. She couldn't help herself. She'd witnessed submersibles and bathysphere spheres before, but she'd hired Beeb because his designs were the most promising, the most ambitious. She was eager to see what the engineer could do. In just a moment, Beeb said. She makes Watcher Tech look like the common bird. He flipped switches and hit buttons, and a flat, murky green lens about the size of a dinner plate rose out of the console, flickering with static until it revealed dark waters and a glint of the Superior's underbelly silhouetted from the dull sunlight above. Magnificent, Maxine breathed. The picture is so clear. Not just a picture, Beeb explained. Everything Calypso feels is fed to this console's readings. Pressure, temperature, even chemical information. though that last one takes a few minutes to be properly broken down into data. What can she tell us for now? Maxine asked. She's drifted down to 20 yards below sea level. Temperature is currently holding at a chilly 7 degrees Celsius. Current is northeasterly. Pressure is, about 36 pounds per square inch. Arata mentioned the seas of Malifaux would be different from ours, possibly chemically. Give me a read on that when you can. Well, we can look into water quality, Beeb said. He steered the Calypso about, circling the Superior. After a few minutes of exposure to the water, a sensor ticker began printing information out, and a long, thin ribbon of paper. Beeb tore a fragment away and began studying it. Looks pretty typical. Looks like oil's in the water, probably from our friendly guild escorts. Oh, this is interesting. Something else is showing up, too. What is it? Well, it's tough. Too complicated for Calypso, Beeb said. Sinewy. Dense. Hard to say if it's native or not. What do you think it means? My guess? Remnants from lunch, Beeb said. Could be old muscle tissue. Doesn't look like anything I've seen before. Maxine pursed her lips. That could be from anything. Sharks, gibbering hordes. Yes, Beeb frowned, reading more of the printout. Maybe they know something we don't. Maxine turned to Kaya, who had been watching impassively. Make sure everyone is alert. Keep them armed and ready for trouble. Yes, ma'am, Kaya said. She turned to leave the room. And Kaya, Maxine called out to her. Remind our escorts as well. Kaya flinched, but managed to smile. I had nearly forgotten. Anything else Calypso can tell us? Maxine asked, turning back to the viewing screen. For the moment, no, Beeb admitted. But if she picks up anything unusual, I'll make a note of it. Maxine pursed her lips. It wasn't proof of a portal, but it was the next best thing. She clapped her hands together. Keep Calypso swimming as long as you can. Inform me the moment you have something. I fear we'll have answers before the day is over.
That's it for another episode of the Breachside Broadcast. Join us next time for part 2 of Uncharted Waters.